Chapter 71. With the bomb hanging grotesquely from its manipulators, Big Ben sat poised on the edge of the great submarine trench that yawned 10 kilometers wide and 2 deep. Inside, Pitt stared grimly down the slope that trailed off into the gloom. The geophysicists had selected a point about 1,200 meters below the rim of the trench wall as the optimum location for the blast to set off a landslide that would in turn launch the seismic sea wave. But the grade was a good 5% steeper than the satellite photos had suggested. And worse, much worse, the upper layer of sediment that formed the sides of the trench was the consistency of oily clay. Pitt had activated a telescoping probe into the silt and was far from overjoyed at the geological test results that read across the computer screen. He realized the danger of his position. It would be a battle to prevent the heavy vehicle from slithering through the slick muck all the way to the bottom of the trench. And once he was committed and plunged Big Ben over the edge, there was no turning back. The cleats on the drive tracks could never gain a grip solid enough to pull the DSMV back up the slope and over the ridge to safety before the explosion. After priming the bomb, he decided to continue on a diagonal course downward along the side of the slope, much like a skier traversing a snow-packed hill. His only chance, and a slightly less than non-existent one, was to use gravity to increase his speed and push Big Ben beyond the clutches of the avalanche before they were both caught up in its force, swept away, and buried for the next 10 million years. Pitt appreciated how narrow the fine dividing line was between survival and death. He thought wryly that Murphy's Law never took a holiday. He missed having Giordino at his side and wondered why all communications had ceased from the C5 galaxy. There had to be a good reason. Giordino and Sandecker would never desert him without cause. It was too late now for explanations and too early for final farewells. It was eerie and lonely with no human voice to prop up his morale. He felt the fatigue sweeping over him in great woolly waves. He slumped in his seat. Any optimism drained away. He examined the coordinates for the detonation site and peered at his watch for the last time. Then he took manual control of Big Ben, engaged the forward drive, and plunged the huge tractor vehicle down the steep slope. The momentum rapidly increased after the first 100 meters, and Pitt began to doubt he could stop the DSMV before it barreled to the bottom of the trench. He quickly discovered that breaking the treads failed to check his speed. Friction did not exist between the cleats and the slick mud. The great mechanical beast began to slide over the slick surface like a runaway truck and semi-trailer hurtling down a steep road grade. The rotund bomb swung wildly in the grip of the manipulators. Because it hung directly in front of his forward view, Pitt could not avoid glancing at the evil thing without conceding it in his mind's eye as the instrument of his own impending death. Suddenly, another terrifying thought mushroomed in his mind. If it broke free and rolled down the slope, he might never be able to retrieve it. He stiffened in desperate fear, not of death, but that he might falter in the home stretch. Pitt moved quickly now, uncaring that he had taken a risk no sane man would ever have contemplated. He slipped the drive into reverse and applied extra power. The cleats wildly thrashed through the slippery ooze backward, and Big Ben sluggishly slowed to a crawl. A wall of silt engulfed the vehicle as he brought it to a full stop. He waited patiently for visibility to return before easing forward for 50 meters, then engaging reverse and drawing the DSMV to a halt again. He continued this series of maneuvers until he regained firm control and had a feel for the interaction between the drive track and the mire. His movements at the controls became hurried now. Each passing minute increased his desperation. At last, after nearly 30 minutes of intense effort to move the big DSMV where he directed it, the navigational computer signaled that he had reached his destination. Thankfully, he found a small level shelf protruding from the slope. He disengaged the power systems and parked. "I have arrived at the detonation site and will begin to arm the bomb," he announced through his communications phone in the forlorn hope Sandecker and Giordino might still be listening in somewhere above. Pitt lost little time in lowering the manipulator arms and setting the bomb in the soft sediment. He released the grippers and interchanged the pincers for working tools. Once more he inserted his hand into the manipulator control and very carefully used a sheet metal shear to cut away the panel on the tapered tail assembly that covered the main fusing compartment. The housing inside contained 4 radar units and a barometric pressure switch. If the bomb had been dropped as planned, the radar units would have bounced their signals off the approaching ground target. Then, at a predetermined altitude, an agreed reading by two units would send the firing signal to the fusing system mounted on the front of the implosion sphere. The second arming system was the barometric switch that was also set to close the firing circuit at a preset altitude. The firing signal circuits, however, could not be closed while the plane was in flight. They had to be triggered by clock-operated switches that were not bypassed until the bomb had dropped well clear of the bomb bay. Otherwise, Denning's demons would have gone up in a pre-detonated fireball. After the panel was removed, Pitt swiveled a miniaturized video camera on the end of the left manipulator. He quickly found the barometric arming switch and focused on it. Constructed of brass, steel, and copper, it showed signs of corrosion but was still intact. Next, Pitt coupled a slender three-pincer hand to one manipulator. The arm was flexed back toward the front of the DSMV, where the pincers opened the heavy mesh lid of a tool crib and removed a strange ceramic object that looked like a small deflated soccer ball. A copper plate was embedded in the concave bottom, surrounded by a pliable bonding material. The appearance was deceiving. The object was actually a very sophisticated pressurized container filled with an inert putty-like compound composed of plastic and acid. The ceramic cover surrounding the caustic substance had been contoured to fit snugly over the barometric firing switch and form a watertight seal. Pitt worked the manipulator hand and positioned the container around the switch. Once it was firmly in place, he delicately pulled a tiny plug that allowed the sea to seep very slowly into the container. When the inert compound inside came in contact with salt water, it chemically turned active and became highly caustic and corrosive. After eating through the copper plate, the thickness governed a delayed sequence of 1 hour, the acidic compound would then attack the copper in the barometric switch, eventually creating an electrical charge that would set off the firing signal and detonate the bomb. As Pitt retracted the manipulators and gently backed Big Ben away from the hideous monstrosity lying like a fat, slimy bulge in the mud, he stole a quick glance at the digital clock on his instrument console. He had run a tight race. Mother's breath would explode 48 years late, but within a new deadline in another time. "Any word?" asked the president anxiously from the Oval Office. "We have an unexplained communications breakdown," Jordan reported from the Situation Room. "You've lost Admiral Sandecker?" "I'm afraid so, Mr. President. We've tried every means at our disposal, but have been unable to re-establish contact with his aircraft." The president felt a numbing fear spread through him. "What went wrong?" "We can only guess. The last pass of the pyramider showed the aircraft had broken off with the deep-sea mining vehicle and was headed on a course toward the island of Okinawa." "That doesn't make any sense. Why would Sandecker abort the mission after Pitt had successfully removed the bomb from Denning's demons?" "He wouldn't, unless Pitt had a serious accident and was unable to complete the detonation." "Then it's over," the president said heavily. When Jordan replied, there was the hollow ring of defeat in his voice. "We won't know the full story until the Admiral makes contact again." "What is the latest on the search for the bomb cars?" "The FBI task force has uncovered and neutralized another three, all in major cities."
"And the human drivers?"
"Every one a diehard follower of Suma and the Gold Dragons, ready and willing to sacrifice their lives. Yet they put up no resistance or made any attempt to detonate the bombs when FBI agents arrested them."
"Why so docile and accommodating?"
"Their orders were to explode the bombs in their respective vehicles only when they received a coded signal from the Dragon Center."
"How many are still out there hidden in our cities?"
There was a tense pause, and then Jordan answered slowly, "As many as 10.
"Good God!"
The wave of shock was followed by an intolerable fear and disbelief.
"I haven't lost my faith in Pitt," said Jordan quietly. "There is no evidence that he failed to prime the firing systems in the bomb."
A small measure of hope returned to the president's eyes.
"How soon before we know?"
"If Pitt was able to adhere to the timetable, the detonation should occur sometime within the next 12 minutes. The president stared at his desktop with an empty expression. When he spoke, it was so softly Jordan could barely make out the words.
"Keep your fingers crossed, Ray, and wish. That's all that's left for us."